Hello, and welcome to Darker Corners, the best and only Justice League Dark show. This is episode 8. I'm the host, Nick Antoine.
Live, damn you, live!
Old business. Last issue, I forgot to mention Harmontown in the list of 5-star worthy podcasts, as well as Girl on Guy. With Aisha Tyler. Shame on ye. New business. Andrew Bennett is in the category of vampire stories worth telling, along with Blade, anyone from the Vampire Chronicles, and Nosferatu. Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula is still waiting to be supplanted. The Leaving, Part 3 of Rise of the Vampires. Before I continue, if you're looking for Part 2 of Rise of the Vampires, you should go ahead and head over to Bennett and the Queen. That's over there on iTunes. You can check it out on Twitter. B and the Q. All one word. B and the Q. The B and the Q are capitalized. That's part two. But as I stated before, you don't need to read part two or listen to part two to fully enjoy the experience of Justice League Dark. You can have the experience enhanced. But, you know, that's how it goes. Them's the breaks. These are the breaks. Let me stop. Alright, this issue was, again, written by Peter Milligan. Art by Daniel Sampier alone, meaning inks and pencils. The colors are done by Admira Wajaya. The letters are done by Dave Sharp. Sharply. The cover was done by Ryan Suk. Or it could be Ryan Suk, but I think it's Suk. Two O's. The associate editor was Chris Conroy, and definitively, I can say, he's not related to Kevin Conroy. And the editor was Matt Idelson. I'm going to stop saying things about the editors, because, I don't know, it's starting to seem a little old hat now. Where we last left off, Deadman and Constantine, John, the man, were headed off to another dimension on a mission given to them by Madame Xanadu. She was on a rooftop with, Zatanna and Shade the Changing Man. We see who they were going after. Again, it's not really spoiling, but again, just in case you haven't read it and for some reason you're stumbling on the podcast, the protagonist, the individual, not so much protagonist, it's a team book, so there's a bunch of them, I guess. He's going about his business, meditating in his own way, not really waiting to be called upon. Really, if anything, going out of his way to seek redemption and solace, which is intriguing and going to be picked upon later. His services are requested and summarily denied, but not in some expected all-out brawl fashion. They literally just talk it out. Shocking. We find ourselves back on the rooftop. And actually, before we do that, I'd like to point out that, as per usual, the other side, or at least one of the other sides in this multifaceted multiverse, is shown to be an all-encompassing veil of white. This is made, well, you can differentiate this from other ones because you can see in certain images the floor he's sitting on looks like it's super polished ice or some kind of bizarre, but the walls or just the area around them are surrounded by a bunch of disfigured individuals. It's bizarre, and it's just subtle enough to miss if you're not paying attention, but But take a closer gander. There is a structure there. Not overly definitive, but it's there. But yes, we find ourselves back on the roof with Rackshade, Madame Xanadu in her trance state, off to meet the individual she went to go meet in the previous issue, in issue 7. And why am I forgetting her name? It's horrible. Zatanna. Interestingly enough, to help bolster the crossover, now they have been visited upon by Mary, Queen of the Vampires. If I'm not mistaken, it's Mary, Queen of Scots. I haven't read the issues in a bit, so any references I make later on will be referenced properly given the episodes of B and the Q, Benedict and Queen. But we see them fighting off a horde of vampires coming to a Sac de Blood, and it's quickly cut to where Xanadu is located. And she, as well, is seeking redemption, but subtly. If you piece together the information from the previous issue and now this one, it seems as if there's an, I don't want to say an exorbitant amount, but more than necessary when it comes to the amount of requesting, begging, that she's doing towards this individual, that you would think if she was able to reach someone like that, if anyone was, they wouldn't have to beg for what she's asking for. And they probably would just be given it. We're shown a cameo, yet again, twice this time, of an individual floating around the city. Figuratively, not literally. And a tornado, which, again, you don't get to see that much unless it's like a flash book, or I guess if Red Tornado's involved, which nowadays that would be, without spoiling anything, Earth 2. Those lines, which I recommend that too. Earth 2 is pretty dope. It's a different tone, but there are some things that get bizarre, and then some things that are just like, oh, okay, you're just telling a story here. Specifically, the new Dr. Fate, and what else was bizarre in that? Or I just say different. It wasn't bizarre. It was different. The take on Alan Scott, there are a sequence of events that occur that end up changing his personality, which you can see it's going to change to, like, super good guy eventually. But where it's at now, it's just very interesting, the choices that the character's being made to make. Intriguing. But again, those are really the only places you see tornadoes. So to see one twice on the same page, I don't know, it's just one of the things you don't see very often. It's very cool to see. The colors are done differently than the previous issue. The previous issue, like I had said, seemed to have a little bit more of a layered paint look, whereas this one is a little bit more like watercolor. But I think that's a bad word to use. But it's a little bit more opaque. I'm not a painter, so I unfortunately don't know the proper term offhand. But as the lightning strikes from above, you see the main antagonist of this particular arc, and it is and her cheekbones. I shouldn't even try and cover that up. I was going to try and cover it up like, oh yeah, it's two antagonists. No, it's a dude. I was just trying to keep it vague. It slipped. This individual's cheekbones. you can see the way that it's layered. It comes a little bit clearer across. And then this is on page, where are you at? 5? If you're digital, it's page 6. When that individual is being attacked by another person, you can see it more prominently above their brow. It's not a criticism at all. I'm just pointing out it's a different type, a different art style occurring, and it evokes a different set of feelings, emotions from reading it as opposed to the previous issue. There's a little bit more urgency as opposed to staying in one place. You know, the absorbing exactly what's going on, which is made prevalent in what happens on the following page, page 8 if you're digital, where Rackshade is being pleaded with to control his M-vest, his meta-vest, his vest that alters reality. And as he's being pleaded with, Madame Xanadu returns feeling as if she's accomplished what she set out to accomplish. Zatanna performing her ninth. This is the ninth time. Yes. The ninth time she's doing backward magic. Drop dead is what's said. Without the Fred. Well, the vampire's name could be Fred, which would be a hilarious joke if that was an in-joke. with the artist and the writer and the editor. Anyway, it's shown that clearly her magic is kind of fading. They've been talking about that this protagonist is acting somewhat like a siphon of magic. Think Zool in Ghostbusters. Xanadu is kind of, you know, warbling on, speaking in tongues, but in English, about the fact that, you know, all of the crap is hitting the fan, yet something seems to be changing. She's concerned that the rest of the team hasn't necessarily returned yet. All the while, this howling vortex is encircling the sky above them as bats swirl in and out of it. Rack Shade seems to be going through a nervous breakdown and is shown to clearly blink out of existence. Before he does so, we get a splash page of assumingly all of the major events, or at least some of the most recent events in his life, exploding all around them and coming to life in its all of its technicolor glory. As it does, he something occurs. Yes, I want to continue to not spoil things. Something occurs, and he finds himself interestingly enough, I guess the best way to say it, inside his coat. It's a very meta moment. I hate that fucking word. Basically, the reality-altering properties of the MetaVest, which I've explained in, I know, definitely, episode 2, of the JLD portion of this podcast, but there's a good chance I talk about it in one as well. It's a very weird vest. Futzes around with metaphysics, but it's as if he kind of TARDIS'd himself and went inside the reality of the vest. And then he finds what he had been attempting to create over the last couple issues, which is very creepy and bizarre. And he ends up finding his source of, I'd say, a combination of redemption and forgiveness. Forgiveness from what he was trying to create, or at least his reasonings behind trying to create it, and unspoken redemption given to him by his teammates. It's poignant, and somewhat passed offhandedly to the side, only because the horde of demons continue to descend upon them, as the queen herself hovers over them, kind of mocking what's going on. Because I've read the other issues, I know she kind of is not against it, but she doesn't necessarily want it to go down that way, so she's more on their side. We get a splash page, three women jumping into battle, which I think is awesome. You don't get to see that kind of stuff not nearly often enough in mainstream graphic novels, but I think it's just either the perception of what the audience, what used to be male-dominated audience would want, heterosexual male-dominated audience at that, or just general perceptions in general. General perceptions in general. Sorry about the redundancy. But it's definitely a nice twist where you normally would just see, for instance, just Wonder Woman or just Catwoman or just Batwoman or just Batgirl or, oh, I should have more, Harley Quinn. Come on, Nick, you can name some more female superheroes. Oh, Hawk Girl, of course. If you want to go pre-Flashpoint, Superwoman. I'll keep that identity secret. If you know what I'm talking about, you know the identity already, but yeah, even that, like, you would see a single individual. Now, I know that there was Birds of Prey, and if I'm not mistaken, the current Batwoman graphic novel run has other superheroines. I'm not 100% definitive on that. So there's a very good chance I'm just 100% wrong. And first issue of Batwoman had this awesome dual splash page with her and, you know, her sidekick or her and her partner in crime, whatever the case is, jumping in the battle. You know what? There you go. I can be definitive about that. Huntress and Power Girl from Earth 2 in the world's finest graphic novel, though. They're in the world's finest. Even though they're also from Earth 2, sets of circumstances have them where they are. So it's called World's Finest. Best way to put that. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff with them jumping into battle. You know, akin to what you would normally see with dudes jumping into battle in a graphic novel, which is just, it's cool. It's action-packed. It's like, it's as if the image itself is moving, even though you know it's static. It's staying still. It's not going anywhere. It's just, I don't know. It's I like it. Like, a lot. I'd also recommend Justice League War, the DC Universe animated film. I think it's about an hour and 15, maybe pushing hour 20, but I think it's like hour 15. Really great. And I, again, don't know why people were so against the portrayal of Wonder Woman in it. It makes perfect sense. If you were to look at any movie, probably more B movies than regular movies, but any movie where there's a warrior, especially in this case a male warrior, that comes from their tribe or from their land or from their country, I guess you should say tribe, country, land, go ever bigger, they're always enamored by the new world, you know. So whether it's, oh come on, you can pull something, whether it's, man, I'm gonna have to go silly with it, okay, whether it's Elf or Mannequin. That's horrible. Oh man, I think it's not even Mannequin 1, it's Mannequin 2. Oh man. But anyway, anytime there's an individual being displaced from their own sense of reality, harkening back to the previous issue's theme, they point out things that are different. And I can kind of see how some people were like, oh, the portrayal makes it come off as if it's childish. But it's not childish, it's naive. Male or female, if you're from a distant land and you come to this new place, you're going to look around at things and be like, oh, that's so cool. You know, that's, you can look at any tourist coming from outside the country and then coming to the United States. They go to Miami, New York, LA, maybe Chicago. They're bound to see, well, not Chicago, the coastal cities. They're bound to see so many different races of people, so many different cuisines, so many different architectural styles, that they're bound to be somewhat taken aback because all of it is so new. It's so new. It can't be more than 200 years old, the structures, which just makes everything that much more prescient. And you flip it around, you take any U.S. tourist that would then in turn go to Japan or go to, let's just say, anywhere in Asia, anywhere in Europe, anywhere in Africa, anywhere in Australia, or let's just say Australia, New Zealand. If they, sorry about that order, that wasn't in preference or anything, I just have how it came out. For the most part, they're going, the individual, unless they travel all the time, they're going to be enamored by all this new stuff. And for them, the new stuff is the fact that it's so old. It's so ingrained in the history of the planet, the history of mankind, humankind rather. It's bound to take someone aback. So if you now put it in this analogy, you have an individual who comes from an entire island. And by island, I mean like a Manhattan-sized island. You know, an island that's at least 10 miles. You know, I go so far, yeah, at least 10 miles in length. To go from this place where only some people, which is what I'm led to believe, only some people know about the fact that men exist, but just for procreation, and then they're sent away. I kind of spoiled it a little bit, but not really. Go read the current run of Wonder Woman. It is amazing. I mentioned it before. It's Brian Cunningham and Cliff Chiang. It's just, it's amazing. But if this individual were to come from this place, and let's just say they knew that men existed, and they knew that they had their place, but they were subservient. And then they come to this new place where now they see one of the subservient individuals serving something that they, you know, serving a food that they've never seen before, they see a child, a female child, eating it. So that's the acceptance. Like, okay, this is okay to imbibe. This is all right for me to eat. They eat it and then are enamored by the fact, like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever tasted in my life, which is true. In this case, ice cream. It looks like strawberry ice cream, which is one of my favorites. Of course, they lose their mind. I lost my mind the first time I genuinely ate strawberry ice cream. I couldn't believe how good it was. And it was because I spent so many years not eating it. The same thing with black cherry ice cream. I spent so much time not eating, I was like, oh, I don't want to eat that, I don't want to eat that. I was like, wow, this is really good. Not so good that you're like, I'm going to eat a whole gigantic bowl. I mean, you just had like a ice cream cone over there? Yeah, that'd be pretty spiffy, man. I can't be mad at that. So, yes, for character development, it made perfect sense. Have Diana, Queen of the Amazons, try something wholly new for her in this new environment as all this crazy stuff is going on around the planet. Just it hadn't hit the fan yet there. And then, you know, it escalates. That was the other thing people were like mad about, that she got called a whore in it. And let's point out, if I'm not mistaken, it was PG-13. Yeah, definitely wasn't R. Probably PG-13 at the worst, maybe PG. Because there's some curses here and there, which was surprising. Like, I know Green Lantern says shit. It's crazy. You hear cursing. It's bizarre. Cool, but bizarre. But the reasoning behind it is explained through her interaction with the person that says it. And she so belittles him. Like, it's so perfect. Like, it's what you would expect somebody who's the queen of an entire society to do. Like, why would they have their ruffles, their feathers ruffled by an individual who knows nothing of how royal they are, let alone a man in this context? It was perfect. It was perfect. And then just the turnabout. Oh, it was so fair play. Oh. Speaking of fair play, I'm going to get into the Mr. Terrific stuff. I don't think I'm doing it. I need to stop doing this. I'm not doing a Mr. Terrific podcast. And I'm saying that, and there's going to be one popping up. It's only 8 issues. But, yeah. Fair play. He's got a fair play tattoo. If you didn't know, chances are you knew that already, though, if you knew who Mr. Terrific was. Anyway, it was an awesome portrayal. I would put it second only in when it comes to portrayal on film thus far. It's 2014, the summer of 2014. I would say thus far it's the second best portrayal, like, you know, film portrayal, next to the Wonder Woman directed DVD, which was outstanding. It was so good. And I think it only got downplayed because it was in that muck and mire period where people drastically stopped buying DVDs and Blu-rays and only downloaded stuff if they were into geeky things. At least it seemed that way if you look at sales figures, because then it jumps up again because people are like, hey, we got to support this stuff. I think if they re-released it anytime next year, actually not anytime next year, if they re-released it later on this year, sometime later on this year, I think it would get huge buzz. Matter of fact, I think if they re-released it now, over the summer, they re-released it in late July, early August, I think the buzz, I'm acting like I'm trying to be all omniscient. No, I know why it would be awesome, because I'm recording this around a certain time. The hype machine, I think people would lose their minds. They'd be like, whoa, this exists? And everyone would be clamoring for that to get turned into a movie. Yeah, of course. Have her be in Superman versus Batman, Dawn of Justice, or Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. I'm sorry, I should know this already. The new Superman movie. And Batman movie. Superman versus Batman, Dawn of Justice. Have her be in that, whether it's like a cameo or actually like fighting, you know, fighting against Superman, let's say, them trying to help Earth or whatever. Whatever is going on in that movie, I accept it. But when it comes to a solo movie, if you want to try and explain, like, okay, where is this woman coming from? Where are people at? That movie is not an origin story. It's not like, oh, she's becoming Wonder Woman for the first time. No, she's already Wonder Woman. Some things happen that are like, oh, this is the first time of this, this is the first time of that. But it is so perfect. And again, yes, I'm biased. Wonder Woman is my favorite female superhero. By far. By far. I'm enamored with it. The creator, William Marston Molson, or William Molson Marston, Dr. Marston, just leave it at that. Him, his wife, and his mistress. I'm fascinated by both their personal lives and their professional lives. The mistress worked for the both of them. He created the lie detector, patented it. Like, is it his correlations everywhere? Oh man, it's just. Wonder Woman is fascinating to no end, and I haven't read every single thing of Wonder Woman, to be honest. I haven't. My knowledge of Wonder Woman extends to when I was younger, much younger, Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, which I thought was crazy awesome. I was just like, this is cool. She's like Xena, but she's not forsaking men completely. Not to say that Xena did, but it just seemed like Xena was like, you know, all men suck. And then Gabrielle was reinforcing that, kind of. I mean, it was a great show. I mean, 5 out of 5 stars. It was awesome. I have nothing bad to say about Xena Warrior Princess. It was awesome. That back-to-back, action-packed hour thing that was going on what was it back then? WPIX? Or just Channel 11, whatever you want to call it. As it was from any tri-state area. To have Xena Warrior Princess and Hercules, the Legendary Journeys, back-to-back, that was just so awesome. I watched all the episodes. They were great. But it was just a different dynamic. It was more towards feminism at the cost of slightly belittling the other sex from time to time. And it worked. It worked to the show. Like, it was cool. It had, like, cheeky little moments. It was really cool. But the personification of Wonder Woman in Justice League and Justice League Unlimited was more like, oh, no, I'm here because I could kick all of their asses, and I just think what they're doing is a good idea, so I'm with them. Like, it's so cool. It's so awesome. So to have that and then go into what I would be able to see is the next thing is to direct a DVD movie. It blew me away. So the new 52 starts up, and then I got that series. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. All that being said, the portrayal on the DVD, the directed DVD, awesome. It's amazing. If you haven't already seen it, go buy it. I know it's on iTunes. If it's not, get it on Amazon. Or if you can't reach there, get it on Amazon. Definitely buy the New 52 Wonder Woman's run. It's outstanding. There's so many in continuity, depending on what you're looking at, DC female heroes that really are just outstanding, that I think are just underappreciated. They're overvalued, not undervalued. They're overvalued, purposefully so. Like, they are so poignant and perfect for the universe, all of them. But to point out how awesome the new 52 version of Wonder Woman is an underservice. I could do so much more. I should be wearing Wonder Woman t-shirts. Seriously, she's amazing. It's just a toss. And I know, you know, I'm a guy, so, you know, it's somewhat sexual. I think it's hot. It's fucking hot. But I think to deny that aspect of yourself is to deny your humanity, which is ridiculous. You know, if you as a woman or as a gay man look at a superhero and are more inclined to read or buy that superhero's fare, their graphic novels, because there's a slight attraction there, you shouldn't deny that. You're a human being. Like, if you think it's sexy, you think it's sexy. If you're a straight male and you're buying all these, like, basically spandexed heroes, there's some kind of, the hero worship is prevalent. You're aspiring, whether it's in your mind or through working out, to be that individual. There's nothing wrong with that. That desire, that fire within us, is what makes us human. If we didn't have it, we would just be automatons, or at best just animals grazing the land, only procreating when it came to having sex, not doing it for pleasure. So yes, I unashamedly think Wonder Woman is the character, the personification of oh, this is the best that a woman could be, sexy as shit. And I'm sure there are women who feel the same way when it comes to Superman, like, oh, this is the best a man can be, yeah, sexy as shit. I totally get it. Hell, let's not be racist. I'm sure people look at Icon and they're like, look, this is the best a man can be, hell yeah, son. Yeah, okay, I just went there. All right, let's go back to the graphic novel. The main bad guy attempts to do away with our three jumping heroes, Mary, Queen of Scots, Madame Xanadu, and Zatanna, attempting to, but failing to. They disappear, assuming that they've, you know, gotten far enough away, but they haven't left the city. So, you know, they're pursued. And beautiful, beautiful, beautiful painting. Especially the background clouds. I'm fascinated when the background is given attention. And the foreground is always going to get attention because that's what you're paying attention to. You know, the heroes, the villains, all that jazz. But the clouds, the different shades of the dusk, I want to say. I think it's been night this whole time. So, no, it'd be dawn. Duh, Nick. From dusk till dawn. It's beautiful. And we get some more imagery veiled sexual imagery, which I always call it, when someone's jumping through a portal. It's very rare, unless it's sliders.
Sliders.
It's usually a portal that is a slit. A bunch of men coming out of a slit, coming to greet a woman. No, it's just, I like it. Fascinating. I think it's intriguing. I was going to say it's hilarious, but it doesn't make me laugh. I just think it's interesting that it's portrayed this way. And then the individual that's coming through just happens to be stubborn, you know, hard-headed, if you will. They arrive without the individual they went to go get in tow. And our heroes, our crazy, crazy individuals are left wondering, what in the hell are we going to do? Constantine even going so far as to say, we could have just stayed home, gotten drunk. The hell we come outside for? This is craziness. And as the cameoed individual looks up into the sky and our different anti-heroes look into the distance, the graphic novel ends. Very, very intriguing issue. It flows by. A couple of these issues have this particular arc, but I think that's the gist that they wanted to have. They wanted you to feel as if you were in some kind of whirlwind scenario. As I mentioned, it seems as if the theme of this particular issue is redemption. Whether it's the returning protagonist, if you will, the words that they had parted upon Deadman and Constantine made it seem as if they were going to go even farther to erase themselves from existence, and they wrestle with that, and the reasonings as to why they believe they should be where they are explored more in their scenes. When it comes to Rackshade, I think it's even more prevalent, given how his story goes on and on. And then ends up crescendoing in a couple scenes. Not crescendoing, like, oh, it's coming to an end, but it's just crazy stuff ends up happening over the course of these different issues. And you have a confrontation that occurs in this particular one that it's clearly shown that he has only been doing what he's been doing because he feels sorry about what he had done before. Which is creepy when you get down to it, because, yeah, so what, man? Like, what you did before was horrible. You should atone for that, but atone for it properly, not alchemically, if you will. That's a nod to Full Metal Alchemist right there. Haven't seen Brotherhood yet. I'm going to get to it. And I'll also say, I guess, less blatantly, Madame Xanadu. She was seeking redemption from her teacher. It was less subtly. Even less subtly. Less subtly? No, that's not even a word. It was less blatant. It was more subtle. Less overt than the returning protagonist. And especially than Rackshade. It seemed, for the most part, it was... Her character has been intoxicated. I don't want to say quite often, but... At least one occasion you see her using, but at least two occasions it seems like she's intoxicated. Two different issues. And that's no way for a leader to behave. And for her to go where she went and talk to who she talked to and ask her what she asked for, it seemed as if it was like, hey, look, okay, I realize what I've been doing may not have been the greatest thing to be doing, but assistance, please. So, you know, to say that redemption is the underlying theme of this particular issue for these three characters, isn't too much of a stretch. I'm not going to go into the wiki for redemption, only because I believe most cynical individuals on the planet are going through some form of redemption in their private life, and it gets so overwhelming that they become as cynical as they are in their public life. Because anyone that's that ill-intended in their public life can't possibly carry that over to when it's time to go to sleep. They'd be pulling their hair out, they'd have all kinds of ulcers, and if that were as much of a mainstay as we're all led to believe that people are that distraught, there would be a lot more Pepto-Bismol commercials and a lot less Pepto-Bismol on the shelves. And as it stands, there's just a few. That and Prilosec. And it's not a lot. There's been an intriguing little issue, as I said. It's been interesting. I gotta get another word instead of interesting, intriguing. And I like fascinating, but it's like the calling card. I don't want to use it. But it's been a good... I don't like that either. It's been a thought-provoking arc. Looking at it from two different sides of the chasm, if you will, you have the Justice League Dark issues that are the odd numbers of this particular Rise of the Vampires arc, and then the I Vampire graphic novel series, the even numbers of 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, even. To see those two sides kind of interweave into each other but not interfere, it makes you question exactly who you should or shouldn't be rooting for in this particular battle, which I think is always the better battle story to tell. If there's a clear delineation between good and evil in a battle, for me, it's no longer fun. You might as well just be playing a regular just shoot 'em up video game. You know, an interesting battle is when the battle lines that have been drawn are squiggly, and some people step over them for various reasons. You know, that's when it's interesting. You know, akin to Bugs Bunny and Yosemite Sam on the cliff, and Bugs Bunny daring him to cross the line. It's intriguing because you know this man's going to keep crossing lines until he's over the edge of the cliff. That's a dire circumstance. If that was to be shown in live action, that would be a creepy thing to see. That would be borderline. Not borderline, that would be a horror movie. It only becomes comedy because he can walk on air. So, to end it off, you know, with the email address, as I normally do, for the show, you can go ahead and type in darkercornerscast@gmail.com. Again, for all you, if I was talking too fast, darkercornerscast@gmail.com. Kind of like a cast of characters providing this podcast. You know, the recording and the laughing in the background. I'm sorry, the non-existent laughing in the background. The producer at the soundboard. Two individuals that edit the final product. And the webmaster. That the email account kind of connotates that entire cast is a part of the Darker Corners. It's not the case, as you know. It's just me. You can follow the show on Twitter. It's at Darker Corners. Again, that's capital D, as in darker, and capital C, as in Chipotle. There's a link in the header. It takes you to the website, as it always does. Of course, if it always isn't doing it at the moment, and it's taking you to iTunes, always isn't doing it is not a real sentence. Deal with it. Of course, you can go rate the show on iTunes. Why would you do that? Why would you write a line or two and say something different? Give the show a couple stars, you know, maybe 5, 4 if you're feeling mean. Because other people then see it, you know, and they're like, oh, this person likes it? I like it too. It's interesting. For some reason, if someone's, as I've mentioned before, if someone verbally tells you something is good or bad, you think or do the opposite. Think and or do the opposite. But if it's written down, people take it at face value, as if someone took the time to actually commit it to history. Digital, as it may be. Which I believe to be just as permanent as paper or stone history, in my opinion. I mean, look, papers can be burned just as easily as a hard drive can be submerged in water. Damn, that sentence could have been awesomer. See? Especially with the awesomer. Papers can be burned just like hard drives can be submerged. And I'm not going to re-edit that, just like I don't re-edit anything else. Which is very true. It's just a matter of keeping them away from their respective destructive elements. A stone tablet can be dropped. You know? Just ask any archaeologist. It's just the case. You just have to preserve your history to the best of your abilities. So if you have all this information on hard drives, just update them to other hard drives if it becomes worn out. If you have something written down on paper, you don't just leave it out in the open. It's going to deteriorate. You got to put it in some glass case with crazy chemicals and, you know, like the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. You know, I think especially Declaration of Independence. I saw that in D.C. It's got chemicals and stuff. And yeah, it's a national treasure too, but come on, go with me here. Reality. You need to find some way to preserve it. So you can't just say, oh, well, just because it's digital, it's not real anymore. It doesn't exist. Come on, man. That just means you don't understand the poignance of object permanence. This has been the 8th episode. I have been Nick Antoine. Yet again, you have been the unwitting listener. Thank you for listening. Step into the dark.